Liar! A clump of shadows is gathered at the foot of the door, black as spilled ink. The shadows take shape, eyes glinting, and I begin to sweat. Why here? Why now? How can creatures of my own mind not be controllable by me? Why can I not will them away? Liar. The shadows rise, morphing into a man-like shape. They take on form and color, and the voice is as familiar and true as if my brother is standing in front of me. Why did you leave me, liar? Darin, I forget that this is a hallucination. That I'm in a martial forge with a murderous-looking blacksmith yards away. The simulacrum tilts its head, just like Darin used to. They're hurting me, liar. It's not Darin. My mind is slipping. This is guilt, fear. The voice changes, twisting and layering, as if there are three Darins all talking at once. The light in the fake Darin's eyes goes out as quickly as a sun in a storm, and his irises darken into black pits as if his entire body is filled with shadow. I won't survive it, liar. It hurts. The simulacrum's hand shoots out to grab my arm, and a bone-deep cold jolts through me. I scream before I can stop myself, and a second later, the creature's hand drops away. I feel a presence behind me, and turn to find Spiro Tullaman, wielding the most beautiful sim I've ever seen. He pushes me casually to the side, holding the sim to the simulacrum. As if he can see the creatures, as if he can hear them.
Begone, he says.
The simulacrum swells, titters, and then falls into a pile of laughing shadows, their cackles falling against my ears like slivers of ice.
We have the boy now. Our brothers gnaw at his soul. Soon he will be mad and ripe. Then we shall feast.
Spiro brings the sim down. The shadows scream, and the sound is like nails on wood. They squeeze under the door, a mass of rats escaping a flood. Seconds later, they're gone. You can see them, I say. I thought they were all in my head. I thought I was going mad.
They're called ghouls, Tullaman says.
But 17 years of scholar pragmatism protest the existence of creatures that are supposed to be nothing but legend. But ghouls aren't real.
They are as real as you or I. They left our world for a time, but they've returned. Not everyone can see them. They feed off sorrow and sadness and the stink of blood.
He looks around his forge.
They like this place.
His pale green eyes meet mine, careful and wary.
I've changed my mind. Tell the Commandant I'll consider her request. Tell her to send me some specs. Tell her to send them with you.
My mind whirls with questions when I leave the smithy. Why did Darin draw Tullaman's shop? How did he get in? Why can Tullaman see the ghouls? Did he see the shadow Darin too? Is Darin dying? If ghouls are real, then are djinn real too? When I arrive back at Blackcliff, I attack my tasks with a single-minded focus, losing myself in the polishing of floors and scrubbing of baths, so that I might escape the cyclone of thoughts in my head. By late evening, the Commandant still has not returned. I head to the kitchen, smelling of polish, my head aching with the indecipherable echo of Blackcliff's drums, which have been pounding all day. Izzy risks a glance in my direction while she folds a stack of towels. When I smile, she offers a tentative twitch of her lips in return. Cook wipes down the counters for the night, ignoring me as usual. I think back to Keenan's advice, to gossip, to keep myself busy. Quietly, I take up a basket of mending and sit at the work table. As I watch Cook and Izzy, I suddenly wonder if they are related, They tilt their heads in the same way. They are both small and fair-haired. And there's a quiet companionship between them that makes my heart ache for Nan. Eventually, Cook turns in for the night, and silence fills the kitchen. Somewhere in the city, my brother suffers in a martial prison. You have to get information, Liar. You have to get the Resistance something. Get Izzy to talk. The Legionnaires were in an uproar outside, I say without looking up from my mending. Izzy makes a polite sound. And the students, too. I wonder why. When she doesn't respond, I shift my sitting position, and she glances over her shoulder at me. It's the trials. She stops her folding for a moment. The Farah brothers came back this morning. Aquila and Veturius barely made it on time. They'd have been killed if they'd showed up even seconds later. This is the most she'd said to me at once, and I have to remind myself not to stare. How do you know all this? I ask. The entire school's talking about it. Izzy lowers her voice, and I inch closer. Even the slaves. Not much else to talk about around here. Unless you want to sit around comparing bruises. I chuckle, and it feels strange, almost wrong, like making a joke at a funeral. But Izzy smiles, and I don't feel as bad. The drums start up again, and though Izzy doesn't halt her work, I can tell she's listening. You understand the drums. They mostly give orders. Blue platoon, report for watch. All cadets to the armory, that sort of thing. Right now, they're ordering a sweep of the eastern tunnels. She looks down at the neat stack of towels. A strand of blonde hair falls into her face, making her appear especially young. When you've been here for a while, you'll learn to understand them. As I take in that disturbing fact, the front door slams shut. Izzy and I both jump.
Slave girl!
It's the commandant.
Upstairs!
Izzy and I exchange a glance, and I'm surprised to find my heart thudding uncomfortably fast. A slow dread sinks into my bones with every step up the stairs. I don't know why. The commandant calls me up every evening to take her clothes for washing and braid her hair for the night. It's no different today, Liar. When I enter her room, she stands at her dresser, idly passing a dagger through a candle flame.
Did you bring back an answer from the swordsmith?
I relay Talaman's reply, and the commandant turns to regard me with cool interest. It's the most emotion I've seen from her.
Spiro hasn't accepted a new commission in years. He must have taken a liking to you.
The way she says it makes my skin crawl. She tests the edge of her knife on her forefinger, then wipes away the drop of blood that beads there.
Why did you open it?
Sir?
The letter, she says. You opened it. Why?
She stands before me, and if running would have done me any good, I'd have been out the door in a heartbeat. I twist the cloth off my shirt in my hands. The commandant tilts her head, awaiting my answer as if genuinely curious, as if I might somehow say something that will satisfy her. It was an accident. My hand slipped and broke the seal.
You can't read, she says, so I don't see why you would bother to open it purposefully. Unless you're a spy planning to give over my secrets to the Resistance.
Her mouth twists into what might be a smile if it didn't appear so joyless. How did she find out about the letter? I think of the scrape I heard in the hallway after I left her rooms this morning. Did she see me tamper with it? Had the courier's office notice a flaw in the seal? It doesn't matter. I think of Izzy's warning when I first got here. The commandant sees things, knows things she shouldn't. A knock comes at the door, and on the commandant's command, two legionnaires enter and salute.
Hold her down,
the Commandant says. The Legionnaires grab me, and the presence of the Commandant's knife is suddenly sickeningly clear. No, please, no! Silence! She draws the word out, softly, like the name of a lover. The soldiers pin me to a chair, their armored hands as heavy as manacles around my arms, their knees coming down on my feet. Their faces give nothing away. Normally, I take an eye for such insolence, the Commandant muses. Or a hand. But I don't think Spiro Tullamon will be so interested in you if you're marred. You're lucky I want a Tullamon blade, girl. You're lucky he wants a taste of you. Her eyes fall on my chest, on the smooth skin above my heart. Please, I say. It was a mistake. She leans in close, her lips inches from mine, those dead eyes lit for just a moment with terrifying fury. Stupid girl, she whispers. Haven't you learned? I don't abide mistakes. She shoves a gag in my mouth, and then the knife is burning, searing, carving a path through my skin. She works slowly, so slowly. The smell of singed flesh fills my nostrils, and I hear myself begging for mercy, then sobbing, then screaming. Darin, Darin, think of Darin. But I can't think of my brother. Lost in the pain, I can't even remember his face.
Chapter 18. Elias. Helene's not dead. She can't be. She survived initiation, the wilds, border skirmishes, whippings. That she'd die now, in the hands of someone as vile as Marcus, is unthinkable. The part of me that is still a child, the part of me that I didn't know still existed until this moment, howls in rage. The crowd in the courtyard pushes forward. Students crane their necks, trying to get a look at Helene. My mother's ice-chiseled face disappears from view. "Wake up, Helene!" I yell at her, ignoring the pressing crowd. "Come on!" She's gone. It was too much for her. For a second that never seems to end, I hold her, numb as the realization sinks in. She's dead. "Out of the way, damn you!" Grandfather's voice seems far away, but a second later, he's beside me. I stare at him, shaken. Only a few days ago, I saw him dead on the nightmare battlefield. But here he is, alive and well. He lays a hand against Helene's throat. "Still alive," he says. "Barely. Clear the way." His simmer's out, and the crowd backs away. "Get the physician. Find a litter. Move."
"Auger,"
I choke out.
"Where's the auger?"
As if my thoughts summon him, Kane appears. I thrust Helene at Grandfather, struggling not to wrap my hands around the auger's neck for what he's put us through.
"You have the power to heal,"
I say through gritted teeth.
"Save her while she's still alive."
"I understand your anger, Elias. You feel pain, sorrow."
His words fall upon my ears like the incessant caws of a crow.
"Your rules, no cheating."
"Calm, Elias. Don't lose it. Not now." "But the Farrars cheated. They knew we were coming through the gap. They ambushed us."
"The Augur's minds are linked. If one of us aided Marcus and Zack, the rest would know. Your whereabouts were concealed from all others."
"Even my mother?"
Kane pauses for a telling moment.
"Even her."
"You've read her mind?"
Grandfather speaks up from beside me. You're absolutely certain she didn't know where Elias was?
Reading thoughts isn't like reading a book, General. It requires study.
Can you read her or not?
Caris Veturia walks dark paths. The darkness cloaks her, hiding her from our sight.
That's a no, then,
Grandfather says dryly.
If you can't read her, I say, how do you know she didn't help Marcus and Zack cheat? Did you read them?
We do not feel the need.
Reconsider.
My temper surges.
My best friend is dying because those sons of a whore pulled the wool over your eyes.
Serena, Kane says to one of the other augurs, stabilize Aquila and isolate the Farrars. No one is to see them.
The augur turns back to me.
If what you say is true, then the balance is upset, and we must restore it. We will heal her. But if we cannot prove that Marcus and Zacharias cheated, then we must leave Aspirant Aquila to her fate.
I nod tersely, but in my head I'm screaming at Kane.
You idiot! You stupid, repulsive demon! You're letting those cretins win! You're letting them get away with murder!
Grandfather, unusually silent, walks with me to the infirmary. When we reach the infirmary doors, they open, and the Commandant emerges.
Giving your lackeys warning, Caris.
Grandfather towers over his daughter, his lip curling.
I don't know what you mean.
You're a traitor to your gens, girl,
Grandfather says, the only man in the Empire brave enough to refer to my mother as a girl.
Don't think I'll forget it.
You picked your favorite, General.
Mother's eyes slide to me, and I spot a flash of unhinged rage.
And I've picked mine.
She leaves us at the infirmary door. Grandfather watches her go, and I wish I knew what he was thinking. What does he see when he looks at her? The little girl she was, the soulless creature she is now. Does he know why she became like this? Did he watch it happen?
Don't underestimate her, Elias, he says. She's not used to losing.
Chapter 19. Liar. When I open my eyes, the low roof of my quarters looms over me. I don't remember losing consciousness. Perhaps I'd been out for minutes, perhaps hours. Through the curtain strung across my doorway, I catch a glimpse of a sky that looks as if it's still undecided as to whether it's night or morning. I push myself to my elbows, stifling a moan. The pain is all-consuming, so pervasive it feels as if I've never been without it. I don't look at the wound. I don't need to. I watch the Commandant as she carved it into me, a thick-lined, precise K stretching from my collarbone to the skin over my heart. She's branded me, marked me as her property. It's a scar I'll carry to the grave. Clean it, bandage it, get back to work. Don't give her an excuse to hurt you again. The curtain shifts. Izzy slips in and sits at the end of my pallet, small enough that she doesn't need to stoop to avoid hitting her head. It's nearly dawn. Her hand drifts to her eye patch, but, catching herself, she knots her fingers into her shirt. The Legionnaires brought you down last night. It's so ugly. I hate myself for saying it. Weak liar. You're so weak. Mother had a 6-inch scar on her hip from a Legionnaire who nearly got the best of her. Father had lash marks on his back. He never said how he got them. They both wore their scars proudly, proof of their ability to survive. Be strong, like them, liar. Be brave. But I'm not strong. I'm weak, and I'm sick of pretending I'm not. Could be worse. Izzy raises a hand to her missing eye. This was my first punishment. How? When? Skies, there's no delicate way to ask about this. I fall silent. A month after we arrived here, Cook tried to poison the Commandant. Izzy toys with her eye patch. I was 5, I think. It was more than 10 years ago now. The Commandant smelled the poison. Masks are trained in such things. She didn't lay a finger on Cook. Just came at me with a hot poker and made Cook watch. Right before, I remember wishing for someone. My mother, my father. Someone to stop her. Someone to take me away. After, I remember wanting to die. 5 years old. For the first time, it sinks in that Izzy has been a slave nearly her whole life. What I've gone through for 11 days, she has suffered for years. Cook kept me alive after. She's good at remedies. She wanted to bandage you up last night, but... well, you wouldn't let either of us near you. I remember, then, the legionnaires throwing my numb body into the kitchen. Gentle hands, soft voices. I fought them with whatever I had left, thinking they meant me harm. Our silence is broken by the echo of the dawn drums. A moment later, Cook's raspy voice echoes down the corridor, asking Izzy if I'm up yet. The Commandant wants you to bring her sand from the dunes for a scrub, Izzy says. Then she wants you to take a file to Spiro Tullaman. But you should let Cook tend to you first. No. My vehemence startles Izzy to her feet. I lower my voice. So many years around the Commandant would make me jumpy too. The Commandant will want the scrub for her morning bath. I don't want to be punished for being late. Izzy nods, then offers me a basket for the sand and hurries away. When I stand, my vision swoops. I wrap a scarf around my neck to cover the K and lurch from my room. Every step is pain. Every ounce of weight pulls at the wound, making me light-headed and nauseous. Unwillingly, my mind flashes back to the single-minded concentration on the Commandant's face as she cut into me. She is a connoisseur of pain, the way others are connoisseurs of wine. She took her time with me, and that made it so much worse. I move to the back of the house with excruciating slowness. By the time I reach the cliff path that leads down to the dunes, my whole body shakes. Hopelessness steals over me. How can I help Darin if I can't even walk? How can I spy if my every attempt is punished like this? You can't save him because you won't survive the Commandant much longer. My doubts rise insidiously from the soil of my mind like creeping, choking vines. That will be the end of you and your family, crushed from existence like so many others. The trail twists and turns back on itself, treacherous as the shifting dunes. A hot wind blows into my face, forcing tears from my eyes before I can stop them, until I can hardly see where I am going. At the base of the cliffs, I fall to the sand. My sobs echo in this empty place, but I don't care. There is no one to hear me. My life in the Scholars' Quarter was never easy. Sometimes it was horrible, like when my friend Zara was taken, or when Darin and I rose and slept with the ache of hunger in our bellies. Like all scholars, I learned to lower my eyes before the marshals, but at least I never had to bow and scrape before them. At least my life was free of this torment, this waiting always for more pain. I had Nan and Pop who protected me from far more than I ever realized. I had Darin, who loomed so large in my life that I thought him immortal as the stars. Gone now, all of them. Liss, with her laughing eyes, so vivid in my mind that it seems impossible that she's been dead 12 years. My parents, who wanted so badly to free the scholars, but who only managed to get themselves killed. Gone, like everyone else, leaving me here alone. Shadows emerge from the sand, circling me. Ghouls. They feed off sorrow and sadness and the stink of blood. One of them screams, startling me into dropping the basket. The sound is eerily familiar. Mercy! They mock in a multi-layered, high-pitched voice. Please, have mercy! I clap my hands over my ears, recognizing my own voice in theirs. My pleas to the commandant. How did they know? How did they hear? The shadows titter and circle. One, braver than the rest, nips at my leg, teeth flashing. A chill pierces my skin and I cry out, stop! The ghouls cackle and pirate my plea. Stop! Stop! If only I had a sim, a knife, something to scare them off, the way Spiro Tullaman did. But I have nothing. So I try instead to stagger away, only to run straight into a wall. At least that's what it feels like. It takes me a moment to realize that it's not a wall, but a person. A tall person, broad-shouldered and muscled like a mountain cat. I flinch back, losing my balance, and two big hands steady me. I look up and freeze when I find myself staring into familiar, pale grey eyes.
Chapter 20 Elias. The morning after the trial, I wake before dawn. Groggy from the sleeping draught, I realize I've been doused with. My face is shaven, I'm clean, and someone's changed me into fresh fatigues. Elias. Cain emerges from the shadows of my room. His face is drawn, as if he's been up all night. He holds up his hand at my instant barrage of questions. Aspirant Aquila is in the very capable hands of Blackcliff's physician, he says. If she's meant to live, she will. The augurs will not interfere, for we found nothing to indicate that the Farrars cheated. We have declared Marcus the winner of the first trial. He has been given a prize of a dagger, and...
What?
He returned first. Because he cheated! The door opens, and Zack limps in. I reach for the blade Grandfather left at my bedside. Before I can fling it at the toad, Cain is between us. I get up and quickly stuff my feet into my boots. I won't be caught lounging on a bed while this filth is within 10 feet of me. Cain steeples his bloodless fingers and examines Zack.
You have something to say.
You should heal her.
Veins stand out in Zack's neck, and he shakes his head like a wet dog ridding itself of water.
Stop it!
He says to the auger.
Stop trying to get in my head! Just heal her, all right? Feeling guilty, you ass?
I try to shove past Cain, but the auger blocks me with surprising swiftness.
I'm not saying we cheated.
Zack looks quickly at Cain.
I'm saying you should heal her. Here.
Cain's whole body goes still as he fixates on Zack. The air shifts and grows heavy. The auger is reading him. I can feel it. You and Marcus found each other. Cain furrows his brow. You were led to each other. But not by one of the augurs, nor by the commandant. The auger closes his eyes, as if listening harder, before opening them.
Well,
I ask, what did you see?
Enough to convince me that the augurs must heal Aspirant Aquila, but not enough to convince me that the Farrars committed sabotage.
Why can't you just look into Zack's mind like you do everyone else's, and...
Our power is not without its limits. We cannot penetrate the minds of those who have learned to shield themselves.
I give Zack an appraising look. How in the 10 hells did he figure out how to keep the augurs out of his head?
You both have an hour to leave school grounds, Cain says. I'll inform the Commandant that I've dismissed you from your duties for the day. Go for a walk. Go to the market. Go to a whorehouse. I don't care. Don't return to the school until evening. And don't come back to the infirmary. Do you understand? Zack frowns.
Why do we have to leave?
Because your thoughts, Zacharias, are a pit of agony. And yours, Vittorius, echo with such deafening vengeance that I can hear nothing else. Neither will allow me to do what I must to heal Aspirant Aquila. So you will leave. Now.
Cain moves aside, and reluctantly, Zack and I walk out the door. Zack tries to hurry away from me, but I've got questions that need answering, and I'm not about to let him worm his way out of them. I catch up to him.
How did you figure out where we were? How did the Commandant know?
She has ways.
What ways?
What did you show Cain?
How did you manage to keep him out of your head at will? Zack!
I pull his shoulder around so he faces me. He throws my hand off, but doesn't walk away.
All that tribal rubbish about djinn and ifrits, ghouls and wraiths. It's not rubbish, Vittorius. It's not myth. The old creatures are real. They're coming for us. Protect her. It's the only thing you're good for.
What do you care about her? Your brother's tormented her for years, and you've never said a word to stop him. Zack regards the sand training fields, empty at this early hour.
You know the worst thing about all this?
He says quietly.
I was so close to leaving him behind forever. So close to being free of him.
It's not what I expect to hear. Ever since we came to Blackcliff, there has been no Marcus without Zack. The younger Farrar is closer to his brother than Marcus's own shadow. If you want to be free of him, then why go along with his every whim? Why not stand up to him?
We've been together for so long.
Zack shakes his head. His face is unreadable where the mask hasn't yet melded.
I don't know who I am without him.
When he walks to the front gates, I don't follow. I need to clear my head. I make for the eastern watchtower, where I strap myself into a harness and rappel down to the dunes. Sand swirls around me. My thoughts are confused. I trudge along the base of the cliffs, watching the horizon pale as the sun rises. The wind grows stronger, hot and insistent. As I walk, it seems like shapes appear in the sands, figures spinning and dancing, feeding off the wind's ferocity. Whispers ride the air, and I think I hear the piercing staccato of wild laughter.
The old creatures are real. They're coming for us.
Is Zack trying to tell me something about the next trial? Is he saying that my mother is consorting with demons? Is that how she sabotaged me in hell? I tell myself that these thoughts are ridiculous. Believing in the Augur's power is one thing, but djinn of fire and vengeance, ifrits bound to elements like wind, sea, or sand. Maybe Zack's just cracked from the strain of the first trial. Mamie Reeler used to tell stories of the Fae. She was our tribe's Kehani, our tale spinner, and she wove whole worlds with her voice, with the flick of a hand or the tilt of her head. Some of those legends stuck in my head for years. The Nightbringer and his hatred for scholars. The Ifrit's skill at awakening latent magic in humans. Soul-hungry ghouls who feed on pain like vultures on carrion. But those are just stories. The wind carries the haunting sound of sobbing to my ears. At first, I think I'm imagining it, and chide myself for letting Zack's talk of the Fae get to me. But then it gets louder. Ahead of me, at the front of the twisting path that leads up to the Commandant's house, sits a small, crumpled figure. It's the slave girl with the gold eyes, the one Marcus nearly choked to death, the one I saw lifeless on the nightmare battlefield. She holds her head with one hand and bats at the empty air with the other, muttering through her sobs. She staggers, falls to the ground, then rises laboriously. It's clear she's not well, that she needs help. I slow, thinking to turn away. My mind roves back to the battlefield and my first kill's assertion that everyone on that field will die by my hand.
Stay away from her, Elias,
a cautious voice urges.
Have nothing to do with her. But why stay away?
The battlefield was the Augur's vision of my future. Maybe I should show the bastards that I'm going to fight that future, that I won't just accept it. I stood by like a fool once before with this girl. I watched and did nothing as Marcus left bruises all over her. She needed help, and I refused to give it. I won't make the same mistake again. Without any more hesitation, I walk toward her.
Chapter 21. Liar. It's the Commandant's son. Baturius. Where did he come from? I push at him violently, then immediately regret doing so. A normal Blackcliff student would beat me for touching him without permission. And this is no student, but an aspirant, and the Commandant's spawn. I have to get out of here. I have to get back to the house. But the weakness that has plagued me all morning takes firm hold, and I fall to the sand a few feet away, sweating and nauseous. Infection. I know the signs. I should have let Cook dress the wound last night.
Who are you talking to?
Baturius asks. No one, aspirant, sir. Not everyone can see them, Tullamon had said of the ghouls. It's clear Baturius can't.
You look terrible, he says. Come into the shade.
The sand. I have to take it up or she'll...
Sit.
It's not a request. He picks up my basket and takes my hand, leading me to the shade of the cliffs and setting me down on a small boulder. When I chance a look at him, he's gazing out at the horizon, his mask catching the dawn light, like water catching the sun. Even at a distance of a few feet, everything about him screams violence, from the short black hair to the big hands to the fact that each muscle is honed to deadly perfection. The bandages that encircle his forearms and the scratches that mar his hands and face only make him look more vicious. He has just one weapon, a dagger at his belt. But then he's a mask. He doesn't need weapons because he is one, particularly when faced with a slave who barely comes up to his shoulder. I try to scoot away further, but my body is too heavy.
What's your name? You never said.
He fills my basket with sand, not looking at me. I think of when the Commandant asked me this question, and the blow I received for answering honestly. Slave girl? He is quiet for a moment.
Tell me your real name.
Though calmly spoken, the words are a command. Liar.
Liar, he says. What did she do to you?
How strange that a mask can sound so kind, that the deep thrum of his baritone can offer comfort. I could close my eyes and not know I was speaking to a mask at all. But I can't trust his voice. He's her son. If he is showing concern, there is a reason for it, and not one that favors me. Slowly, I push back my scarf. When he sees the K, his eyes go hard behind the mask, and for a moment, sadness and fury burn in his gaze. I'm startled when he speaks again.
May I?
He lifts a hand, and I barely feel it when his fingers brush the skin near my wound. Your skin's hot. He lifts a basket of sand. The wound is bad. It needs attention. I know that, I say. Commandant wanted sand, and I didn't have time to... Veturius's face swims for a moment, and I feel strangely weightless. He's close then, close enough for me to feel the heat of his body. The scent of cloves and rain drifts over me. I close my eyes to stop everything from lurching, but it doesn't help. His arms are around me, hard and gentle all at once, and he lifts me up. Let me go! My strength peaks, and I shove at his chest. What is he doing? Where is he taking me? How else do you plan to get back up the cliffs? He asks. His broad strides carry us easily up the winding switchbacks. You can barely stand. Does he actually think I'm stupid enough to accept his help? This is a trick he's plotted with his mother. Some further punishment awaits. I have to escape him. But as he walks, another wave of dizziness hits me, and I clutch his neck until it passes. If I hold on tight enough, he won't be able to throw me to the dunes. Not without getting dragged down himself. My eyes fall on his bandaged arms, and I remember that the first trial ended yesterday. Veturius catches me looking.
Just scratches, he says. Augurs left me in the middle of the great wastes for the first trial. After a few days without water, I started falling down a lot.
They left you in the wastes? I shudder. Everyone's heard of that place. It makes the tribal lands look almost habitable. And you survived. Did they at least warn you?
They like surprises.
Even through my sickness, the impact of what he said isn't lost on me. If the aspirants don't know what will happen in the trials, how can I possibly find out? Doesn't the Commandant know what you'll be up against? Why am I asking him so many questions? It's not my place. My head must be addled from the wound. But if my curiosity bothers Veturius, he doesn't say so.
She might. Doesn't matter. Even if she knows, she wouldn't tell me.
His mother doesn't want him to win. Part of me wonders at their bizarre relationship. But then I remind myself that they're marshals. Marshals are different. Veturius crests the cliff and ducks beneath the clothes fluttering on the line, heading down the slave's corridor. When he carries me into the kitchen and sets me down on a bench beside the work table, Izzy, scrubbing the floor, drops her brush and stares open-mouthed. Cook's glance falls to my wound, and she shakes her head.
Kitchen girl! Cook says. Take the stand upstairs. If the Commandant asks about Slave Girl, tell her she's taken ill and that I'm tending to her so she can get back to work.
Izzy picks up the basket of sand without a sound and disappears. A wave of nausea breaks over me, and I'm forced to drop my head between my legs for a few moments.
Lyra's wound's infected,
Veturius says when Izzy leaves.
Do you have blood root serum?
If Cook is surprised that the Commandant's son is using my given name, she doesn't show it.
Blood root's too valuable for the likes of us. I've tan root and wildwood tea.
Veturius frowns and gives Cook the same instructions Pop would have. Wildwood tea 3 times a day, tan root to clean the wound, and no bandage. He turns to me.
I'll find some blood root and bring it to you tomorrow. I promise. You'll be all right. Cook knows her remedies.
I nod, unsure if I should thank him, still waiting for him to reveal his true purpose for helping me. But he doesn't say anything else, apparently satisfied with my response. He stuffs his hands in his pockets and walks out the back door. Cook rustles around the cabinets, and a few minutes later, a mug of steaming tea is in my hands. After I drink it down, She sits in front of me, her scars inches from my face. I gaze at them, but they no longer seem grotesque. Is it because I've gotten used to seeing them, or because I have a disfigurement of my own?
Who's Taryn?
Cook asks. Her sapphire eyes glint, and for a moment they are hauntingly familiar.
You called for him in the night.
The tea takes the edge off my dizziness, and I sit up. He's my brother.
I see.
Cook drips tanroot oil on a square of gauze and dabs it onto the wound. I wince in pain and grip the seat.
And is he in the resistance too?
How could you know that? I almost say. But then I recover my wits and press my lips together. Cook catches the slip and pounces.
It's not hard to tell. I've seen 100 slaves come and go. Resistance fighters are always different. Never broken. At least not when they first arrive. They have hope.
She curls her lip as if she's speaking of a colony of diseased criminals instead of her own people.
I'm not with the rebels.
I wish I hadn't spoken. Darren says my voice goes high when I lie, and Cook seems like the type to notice. Sure enough, her eyes narrow.
I'm not a fool, girl. Do you have any idea what you're doing? The Commandant will find you out. She'll torture you, kill you. Then she'll punish anyone she thinks you were friends with. That means is... Kitchen girl.
I'm not doing anything wrong.
There was a woman once, she interrupts me abruptly. Join the resistance. Learn to mix powders and potions so that the very air would turn to fire and stones to sand. But she got in over her head. Did things for the rebels, horrible things that she never dreamt she'd do. Commandant caught her like she'd caught so many others. Carved her up good and ruined her face. Made her swallow hot coals and ruined her voice. Then she made the woman a slave in her house. But not before killing everyone the woman knew. Everyone she loved.
No, no. The source of Cook's scars becomes sickeningly clear. She nods, grimly acknowledging the dawning horror on my face.
I lost everything. My family. My freedom. All for a cause that never had any hope to begin with.
But before you came here, the resistance sent a boy.
Zane. He was supposed to be a gardener. Did they tell you about him?
I almost shake my head but stop, crossing my arms instead. She doesn't acknowledge my silence. She's not guessing about me. She knows.
It was 2 years ago. Commandant caught him. Tortured him in the school's dungeon for days. Some nights we could hear him screaming. When she was done with Zane, she gathered every last slave in Blackcliff. She wanted to know who'd been friends with him. Wanted to teach us a lesson for not turning in a traitor.
Cook's eyes are fixed on me, unrelenting.
Killed 3 slaves before she was satisfied that the message had sunk in. Lucky I'd warned Izzy away from the boy. Lucky she listened.
Cook gathers her supplies and shoves them back into a cabinet. She picks up a cleaver and hacks at a bloody slab of meat waiting on the work table.
I don't know why you ran away from your family to join those rebel bastards.
She flings the words at me like stones.
I don't care. Tell them you quit. Ask for another mission. Somewhere where you won't hurt anyone. Because if you don't, you'll die. And Skies only knows what will happen to the rest of us.
She points the cleaver at me, and I shift back in my chair, watching the knife.
Is that what you want?
She says.
Death? Easy. Tortured.
She leans forward, spittle flying from her mouth. The knife is inches from my face.
Is it?
I didn't run away, I burst out. Pop's body Nan's glazed irises, Darin's flailing limbs all flash before my eyes. I didn't even want to join. My grandparents, Amas came. I bite my tongue. Shut it, Naya. I scowl at the old woman, unsurprised to see her glaring back. Tell me the truth about why you joined the rebels, she says, and I'll keep my mouth shut about your dirty little secret. Ignore me, and I'll tell that ice-hearted vulture upstairs exactly what you are. She drives a cleaver into the work table and drops into the seat next to me, waiting. Damn her. If I tell her about the raid and what came after, she might still rat me out. But if I say nothing, I've no doubt that she'll march to the Commandant's room this instant. She's just insane enough to do it. I have no choice. As I speak of what happened that night, she remains silent and unmoved. When I finish, my eyes are swollen, but Cook's mangled face reveals nothing. I wipe my face on my sleeve. Darin's stuck in prison. It's only a matter of time before they torture him to death or sell him as a slave. I have to get him out before then, but I can't do it alone. The rebels said if I spied for them, they'd help me. I stand, shakily. You could threaten to turn my soul over to the Nightbringer himself. Doesn't matter. Darin's my only family. I have to save him. Cook says nothing, and after a minute passes, I assume she's chosen to ignore me. Then, as I move to the door, she speaks. Your mother, Mira? At the sound of mother's name, I jerk my head around. Cook is examining me. You don't look like her. I'm so surprised I don't bother to deny it. Cook has to be in her 70s. She'd have been in her 60s when my parents controlled the resistance. What was her real name? What had her role been? You knew my mother? Knew her? Yes, I knew her. Always liked you, your father better. She clears her throat and shakes her head in irritation. Strange. I've never heard her stutter. Kind man. Smart. Man, not like your mother. My mother was the lioness. Your mother isn't worth your words. Cook's voice drops into a snarl. Never, never listen to anything but her own selfishness. The lioness. Her mouth twists around the name. She's the reason I'm here. Her breath heaves now, as if she's having some sort of fit. But she barrels on, determined to get out whatever it is she wishes to say. The lioness, the resistance, and their grand plans. Traitors. Liars. Fools. She stands and reaches for her cleaver. Don't trust them. I don't have a choice, I say. I have to. They'll use you. Her hands shake, and she grips the counter. She gasps out the last few words. They take, and then they'll throw you to the wolves. I warned you, remember? I warned you.
Chapter 22 Elias. At exactly midnight, I return to Blackcliff in full battle armor, dripping with weaponry. After the trial of courage, I'm not about to be caught shoeless with only a dagger for defense. Though I'm desperate to know if hell is all right, I resist the urge to go to the infirmary. Kane's orders to stay away didn't leave room for argument. As I stalk past the gate guards, I fervently hope not to run into my mother. I think I'd snap at the sight of her, especially knowing that her scheming nearly killed Helene, and especially after seeing what she'd done to the slave girl this morning. When I'd seen the K carved into the girl, Liar, I'd flexed my fists, imagining, for one glorious moment, the feel of inflicting such pain on the Commandant. See how she likes it, the hag. At the same time, I wanted to back away from Lyra in shame, because the woman who'd done such evil shares my blood. She is half of me. My own reaction, that ravenous lust for violence, is proof. I'm not like her. Or am I? I think back to the nightmare battlefield. 539 bodies. Even the Commandant would be hard-pressed to take so many lives. If the augurs are right, I'm not like my mother. I'm worse.
You will become everything you hate,
Kane had said when I'd considered deserting. But how could leaving my mask behind make me any worse of a person than the one I saw on that battlefield? Lost in my thoughts, I don't notice anything unusual about Skull's quarters when I arrive at my room. But after a moment, it sinks in. Leander's not snoring, and Demetrius isn't mumbling his brother's name. Faris's door isn't open, as it almost always is. The barracks are abandoned. I draw my Sims. The only sound is the occasional pop of the oil lamps flickering against the black brick. Then, one by one, the lamps go out. Grey smoke seeps beneath the door at one end of the hall, expanding like a roiling bank of storm cloud. In an instant, I realize what's happening. The second trial, the trial of cunning, has begun.
Watch out!
A voice shouts from behind me. Helene, alive, shoves through the doors at my back, fully armed and without a hair out of place. I want to tackle her in a hug, but instead I drop to the floor as a volley of razor-edged throwing stars hurtles through the space where my neck was. The stars are followed by a trio of attackers who spring from the smoke like coiled snakes. They are lithe and quick, their bodies and faces wrapped in funereal strips of black cloth. Almost before I'm on my feet, one of the assassins has a Sim at my throat. I spin back and kick his feet out from under him, but my leg meets only air. Strange. He was there, just now. At my side, Helene's Sim flashes swift as quicksilver as an assassin presses her toward the smoke.
Evening, Elias!
She calls over the clash of Sims. She catches my eye, an irrepressible grin spreading across her face.
Miss me?
I don't have the breath to answer. The other two assassins come at me fast, and though I fight with both Sims, I can't get the upper hand. My left Sim finally hits its mark, sinking into the chest of my opponent. Bloodthirsty triumph surges through me. Then the attacker flickers and disappears. I freeze, doubting what I've seen. The other assassin takes advantage of my hesitation and shoves me back into the smoke. It's as if I've been dropped into the darkest, blackest cave in the Empire. I try to feel my way forward, but my limbs are leaden, and in moments I slip to the floor, my body a dead weight. A throwing star cuts through the air, and I barely register the fact that it has grazed my arm. My Sims hit the stone of the hallway, and Helene screams. The sounds are muted, as if I'm hearing them through water.
Poison.
The word brings me out of my senselessness. The smoke is poisonous. With my last shreds of consciousness, I scour the ground for my Sims and crawl out of the darkness. A few breaths of clean air help me reclaim my wits, and I notice that Helene has disappeared. As I search the smoke for any sign of her, an assassin emerges. I duck beneath his Sim, intending to wrap my arms around his chest and slam him to the floor. But when my skin meets his, cold lances through me, and I gasp and jerk away. It feels as if I've dipped my arm into a bucket of snow. The assassin flickers and disappears, reappearing a few yards away.
They're not human, I realize.
Zack's warning echoes in my head.
The old creatures are real. They're coming for us.
10 burning hells.
and I thought he had cracks. How is it possible? How could the augurs have...